This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very pleased today to be speaking with Dr. Rachel Gordon about her book titled Post-War Stories, How Books Made Judaism American, which is really interesting because it looks at a very particular genre of literature that is doing rather a lot in the post-World War II period in America to shape American Jewish identity within Jewish communities to the non-Jewish communities within the United States. There's so much to get into about these texts and kind of what they're doing and the society and culture that they're in. So Rachel, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast to tell us about your book.
Thank you so much, Miranda. It's such a pleasure to be here.
Could you please start us off by introducing yourself a little bit and explain why you decided to write this book?
Of course. I'm an assistant professor in the Department of Religion and the Bud Shorstein Center for Jewish Studies at the University of Florida. And this book was inspired by my doctoral dissertation at Harvard. I say inspired because I think not a single paragraph is still standing from that dissertation, which was titled How Judaism Became an American Religion. So in that dissertation, I was looking at this changing status of Jews and Judaism. And then, like many people after getting their PhD, I sort of needed to take a break from the dissertation. And when I was ready to come back and look at it, I was looking for what was my main contribution here to the study of American religion and Jewish studies. And what I decided is it was my examination of middle-brow literature that really offered something new to scholars of, I hope, many disciplines who are interested in post-war American religious history and Jewish history and American Jewish literature. And I guess the other thing I'd say in introducing myself, because this is a book that I wrote with both my academic colleagues and students and non-academics in mind, is that I host a podcast on academic writing and publishing. It's called Writing It, the podcast about academics and writing, which I found actually useful in writing this book too.
Wonderful. Thank you for that introduction. It's always interesting to kind of hear how people come into projects and, you know, come back into projects and go, right. Okay, hang on. What am I going to do with this? Mm-hmm. So getting into then the book, can you kind of take us back in time to the immediate post-World War II years in the United States? Why at this point was there a focus on explaining Judaism in terms of religion rather than in terms of race or in terms of nationality? Why was this the focus, and kind of who was leading these conversations?
As we know, Jews were often discussed or thought about as a race or as a people or a nation during much of the first half of the 20th century. But one of the, I guess I hesitate to say silver linings, but maybe a sort of silver lining of World War II or Hitler is that the Nazis end up delegitimizing this racial discourse around Jews, which is not to say that it totally disappears in the 40s, but we really see this conscious effort among people who consider themselves educated and enlightened to steer Americans away from the racial thinking and talking about Jews and towards a discourse around religion. So anthropologists kind of lead this effort, but then we see writers, novelists, and writers who focus on presenting or explaining religion joining this effort to change the way we thought about Jews in the U.S. So one of the ways we see this is in the anti-Semitism literature in the 1940s, is that these novelists, part of what they're doing is including scenes where we see characters move away from race talk and think to religion talk or think about Jews. And sometimes you see one character actually teaching another, oh, this is, you know, it's not correct to talk about Jews as a race. And sometimes we see a character internally having that thought process themselves. For instance, I'm thinking of the anti-Semitism novel Earth and High Heaven by Gwethelyn Graham. This was published in 1944. We see a Jewish character who's, I think, in Yom Kippur services, he's kind of thinking about the meaning of Jewishness. And so we follow his interior monologue where he's realizing that race is not quite right and religion is maybe more right, and yet religion doesn't totally feel right to him as a Jew. So in effect, the 40s are a period of kind of shifting Americans from race to religion, but the race discourse does not totally disappear. And the religion discourse has its problems, or people have some reluctance to totally take it up.
Such as?
In terms of the reluctance, I'm thinking of an article in Commentary by a sociologist that I mention in the book, where he's explaining why race, even though he knows it's not right, doesn't totally feel right to him. I'm not sure if I said that correctly, but what I meant to say was that we find in the anti-Semitism novels, we see characters who express some of the dissatisfaction with totally moving away from race to religion. That what they're expressing there is the sense that religion is not only that Judaism is not only a religion, that it seems to overflow the boundaries of religion and not fit it exactly. This is this idea that that Judaism is so much more than a religion. Mm-hmm. So what these anti-Semitism novels then are able to express is that religion is no longer correct, that race is no longer correct, but that religion does not fully capture what Jewishness is either.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that makes sense and kind of sets up a useful tension to poke at. But I want to make sure we all kind of know what type of literature we're talking about, because it's really interesting. So you've mentioned anti-Semitism literature. Can you tell us about the genres and mediums that you focus on in the book and kind of why these ones?
Yeah. So in post-war stories, I'm looking at two genres, the anti-Semitism novels. And this is a group of novels attacking anti-Semitism and explaining anti-Semitism as un-American. These are being written and published during the 1940s, so both during World War II and right after. So they clearly have the backdrop of the Nazis to inform what is going on. And we usually see some reference to World War II in the novels, but they're really about the American scene, or at least the anti-Semitism novels that I look at are focused on the US. And so the implicit message there seems to be how can we be fighting this war in Europe and not take a look, an honest look at the problems with anti-Semitism and discrimination in our own country. So it was an effort to clean up things on the American scene that I think was informing the novels. And in a way, there's a little bit of a humble brag in them, in that because World War II was in the backdrop, many of these authors seem to be pointing out, we have our problems here in the US, but since we all know what's just been going on in Europe, obviously our evil doesn't measure up to what the Europeans have been up to, which was supposed to be sort of, you know, inspire Americans to do even better, and also express some American exceptionalism, that we don't have the problems that our European enemies do, and we're so good that we are willing to expose our problems and really honestly grapple with them in popular literature, some of which even becomes, you know, like Gentleman's Agreement became a Academy Award winning film. So it's the irony that while these anti-Semitism novels were pointing out problems in American society, I really felt like several of them, especially Gentleman's Agreement, which is the star among them, had this pride, this American patriotism also, that Americans were sort of this good about dealing with their problems.
Hmm. Thank you for introducing us to one of the genres. What's the other one?
The other genre is the introduction to Judaism genre. So kind of like after 9/11, how we saw this surge of books and media presentations explaining Islam and Muslims, sort of as though 9/11 had shone a spotlight on this group that many Americans realized they didn't know much about, that they didn't understand Muslim religion. World War II also shone a spotlight on a tiny group, the Jews. And I think we forget how little Americans understood Jewish religion and Jewish culture before the post-World War II era. Just as a reminder, as I mentioned in the book, the first half of the 20th century was still a time when most non-Jews, you know, had not been to a Passover Seder or a bar mitzvah or a circumcision. These are all sort of Jewish religious events that many educated non-Jewish Americans attend these days, that's sort of part of your cultural experience. And it was still a time when many non-Jewish Americans had never met a Jew. Many of us have heard these stories of Christians asking the first Jew they met, do you have horns, or having all sorts of other stereotypical understandings of what Jewishness was that really showed their ignorance. And I found that too in my research, that educated non-Jews would ask questions about Jewish religion that are really surprising, such as, do Jews still sacrifice like they do in the Hebrew Bible? So for these Christians, their understanding of Judaism was very much based on the Hebrew Bible. So the introduction to Judaism literature was trying to explain Judaism in a sympathetic way to non-Jews, but also to Jews, because many of the authors of these books, and sometimes they were magazine articles, were rabbis or Jewish communal leaders, and they realized that a lot of their Jewish congregants or just other Jews in America were kind of estranged from the religion of their ancestors. Many had not received great Jewish religious educations or had been living kind of secular lives, especially during the 1930s or 1920s, which weren't known as super religious times in American culture the way the late 40s and 50s were. And because we have the Cold War in the late 40s and 50s, there's this sense among Jewish intellectuals and rabbis that Americans are living in a time when they need to have some religion, that, you know, young children even would be asked on the playground or from their classmates these questions of sort of, what are you? And the answer to that question during the Cold War was supposed to be some religion. A child needed to be to be able to say, I'm a Protestant, I'm a Catholic, or I'm a Jew. Those were the three religions that by the 50s were considered American religions. So the introduction to Judaism literature was giving both Jewish readers and non-Jewish readers a kind of sympathetic explanation of this religion that had seemed so shadowy and mysterious, and doing it in a way that made religion sort of palatable and middle class and acceptable in the post-war era. I think that for readers of the book, it comes as a surprise to realize how absent that was before the 40s or 50s. There just weren't that many books about Judaism written in English that were accessible to Americans.
So obviously, in your description of both of those genres, that gives us kind of some ideas of like why you might be interested in looking at them. But I was wondering if there's anything further you want to tell us about how you selected them.
I guess since my focus here was really on middle brow literature, I label this mid-20th century era the mid-century middle brow moment in American Jewish culture. And part of what I mean by that is that in the decades after the kind of late 60s and 70s, we have this glorious American Jewish literature that's pretty highbrow, novels by Saul Bellow, Philip Roth, Bernard Malamud. And that is the American Jewish literature that many of us Americans really respect and feel pride in. But in these couple of decades before that, we have some pretty middle brow literature that was very popular at the time. Some of it was bestsellers. And it was important, I'm saying, because it has these two aims of combating anti-Semitism and explaining Judaism. But this literature has often gotten overlooked because it is so middle brow. Some of it is pretty apologetic and it seems pretty banal to us. Much of it does, if you read these Intro to Judaism articles and books today. It is hard on first reading to see what's so revolutionary here. It's easier to understand that when you're thinking about what came before in terms of all the anti-Semitism of the 1920s and 30s and early 40s, to then understand why so many readers, Jewish and non-Jewish, wrote into these authors and editors and publishers saying how important it was to actually read something uplifting and ennobling and with dignity about Judaism and Jews in America.
Can you tell us a bit more about that? Obviously, as you said, quite a strong reaction. Was that sort of the main feature of anti-Semitism novels? Kind of did that change as it went from the 20s to the 30s to the 40s? And who was writing these?
When you ask what changed,
in terms of like was the key feature of the novels kind of about this idea of portraying something positive about Judaism in order to combat anti-Semitism? Was that kind of the main goal of the novel, of these types of novels? And did that change as people became more familiar with the genre? Like, I know in many things you kind of start in one place and then as readers get more familiar with it, you might develop other themes. Was that the case here?
I think one of the goals with the anti-Semitism literature was to show, especially non-Jews, how they could be good allies, as we would say today. So in Gentleman's Agreement, for instance, we've got a non-Jewish main character, Phil Green, and his girlfriend, and then fiance Kathy, who are the main characters who are kind of learning how to be anti-Semitic. And we only have a few actual Jewish characters who are kind of on the margins of the book. And so I think that this was the strategy of the novelist Laura Z. Hobson. She didn't want this to be labeled a Jewish book, and she wanted it to be sort of useful to non-Jewish readers in figuring out what they could do to fight anti-Semitism. So she sort of provides a model, this white Christian savior type of main character, showing how he moves from kind of unthinking anti-Semitism, or perhaps a better way to describe it for Phil is that he doesn't think much about anti-Semitism, although he's not one to be anti-Semitic himself, to being able to recognize the problem and actually be morally outraged by it. In fact, the novelist Hobson, who was Jewish, although readers usually did not know that, received a lot of mail along the lines of how wonderful it is that a non-Jew like you would be so morally outraged by this novel about anti-Semitism that you would write this novel attacking it. And that, in a way, was the kind of America she wanted to live in. Her point was that a non-Jew should be so morally outraged by this. And that's why she shows a Gentile as her main character. Other examples of the anti-Semitism novels also included non-Jews, but I'm thinking of Wasteland, which was written by the Jewish woman writer Jo Sinclair, which was a pen name for Ruth Side. And that one features, very unlike Gentleman's Agreement, it features a Jewish working class male protagonist and his relationship with his psychiatrist, who helps him kind of overcome some of the negative thinking that resulted from him having absorbed anti-Semitic views about Jews and his family and his upbringing. So that novel is very focused on the interior landscape of a Jew. And then I'm also thinking of Gwethlyn Graham's book, Earth and High Heaven, which I mentioned earlier, written by a Toronto-born non-Jewish novelist. This was another very popular example, and it was going to be made into a film, but Gentleman's Agreement beat it to it, since Gentleman's Agreement was made into a movie before. But these are three examples written by women, which is part of the reason I have a chapter in the book that is called When Women Made Anti-Semitism Fiction Popular, because it did turn out that a few women wrote the more popular of these anti-Semitism novels. And I think a lot of that is because they were thinking sort of strategically about the kind of average American reader. And they ended up writing novels that a full range of readers could really relate to.
So speaking of that full range of readers, to what extent did these novels engage with other forms of hatred?
Wasteland, the novel by Jo Sinclair, does this explicitly. The novel talks about how anti-Semitism is connected to anti-Black sentiment. And although it doesn't mention it explicitly, we know that the sister of the main character is a lesbian. In fact, Wasteland is known as the first positive portrayal of a lesbian character in a novel. And so it's kind of implicit that anti-Semitism is related to homophobia too. The lesbian character does link anti-Semitism to all other kinds of hatred in America. The other examples of this of anti-Semitism novels don't do this as much. And I had a chance to speak a bit to one of Hobson's, that's Laura Z. Hobson, the author of Gentleman's Agreement, her son. And I asked him about this because I was intrigued by why Hobson didn't address racism at the time. And the answer that he gave me is one that feels right to me too. He felt that Laura Hobson felt that anti-Semitism shouldn't need to be connected to other attentions to deserve, to other hatreds to deserve attention, and that it was worthy of attention on its own. I think this does make some sense in the 1940s context. In fact, remember when I was researching the film, there was one remark in a letter about how readers of the novel were hoping that the Hollywood studios would have the courage to actually make the film be about anti-Semitism too, and not turn it into a movie about racism. And I think in some ways it did feel easier for a lot of these Jewish studio heads to move the attention away from Jewishness or anti-Jewishness towards other kinds of hatred. And it was a kind of new post-war courage to address anti-Semitism on its own. What I mean by that is, I think in the 20s and 30s and even early 40s, there was a feeling that to complain or speak out about anti-Semitism was kind of vulgar or not sophisticated or not enlightened or not universalistic enough, that it was okay to speak out on behalf of maybe other people. But if you were just focused on your own group, and this being maybe Jews in particular, that was a form of what was then called special pleading, which wasn't okay, even though I think today we understand that groups will naturally want to advocate for other members of their groups. I think in the 40s, many Jewish intellectuals were still struggling with this issue of how to speak out about anti-Semitism or problems that were specifically centered on Jews in a way that did not seem too parochial or narrow-minded or tribalistic. There was some sense that that was something that maybe rabbis or communal leaders did, but if you saw yourself as being part of a wider sort of intellectual community, was this sort of proper behavior to speak out against anti-Semitism? And this mood of anti-Semitism that I describe as kind of growing in the 40s follows how intellectuals start to find the courage to do that more, to speak out against anti-Semitism.
Really interesting evolution. Thank you for taking us through that. Given that the book talks about two genres, obviously I've been asking you about one of them, but I'd like to bring the other one in. To what extent can we understand the development of the introduction to Judaism sort of texts or genres? Were they reactions to the popularity of anti-Semitism novels?
This is a great question. Thank you. And in the book, this is somewhat how I tell the story, that introduction to Judaism, the genre, somewhat emerged in response to the anti-Semitism novels, in part because rabbis were noticing, paying attention to this this new awareness, recognition of anti-Semitism in the 40s and some of these very successful anti-Semitism novels, especially Gentleman's Agreement, which did get a lot of attention from rabbis who gave sermons on it or wrote little pieces on it in their synagogue bulletins. And a few rabbis, I'm thinking it's particularly of Rabbi Joshua Loth Liebman, who was from Boston's Temple Israel, and Rabbi Milton Steinberg of Manhattan's Park Avenue Synagogue, both felt this ambivalence, which I can explain as, on the one hand, isn't it wonderful that there are popular novels out there attacking anti-Semitism as un-American and which are getting readers from both Jews and non-Jewish segments of society. But on the other hand, most of these novels don't do much in terms of giving the reader a good idea of Judaism or even Jewishness. And again, Gentleman's Agreement is a prime example of this. As critics were quick to point out, readers finish the novel or finish the film with no more understanding of Judaism than when they started it. And unsurprisingly, rabbis in particular felt that this was a missed opportunity. Can't we, along with attacking anti-Semitism, they were saying, can't we also show readers, show Americans that there's so much positive to Judaism, that there is joy, that there is meaningful ritual, that there's so much they don't understand about this Jewish religion that might be helpful to them in their own lives too, whether they're Jewish or not. So in that way, a few of the authors of Introduction to Judaism literature were kind of picking up where they felt the anti-Semitism literature had left off. Now that we're on the same page that about anti-Semitism being wrong and bad, let's step into a more positive space of learning about this history and culture and religion that Americans don't know enough about.
Mm. That's a really interesting to kind of think of them going, hang on a second, there's something happening here. But I want to kind of link it up with something you mentioned earlier, because it's not just that these novels are getting attention and popular, and therefore there's that aspect of kind of an appetite, an audience to speak to. You mentioned earlier that religion in general is kind of a bigger deal in the late 40s and 50s than it is in the 20s and 30s generally. Why? And how did Judaism factor into this?
Yeah, I spend a bit of time on this in Postwar Stories, explaining why I consider this postwar moment a religion moment, too. This is because of the Cold War and because of American sense that it is now part of the American way of life to affiliate with an American religion. As I mentioned before, it's Protestantism, Catholicism, and Judaism, but the Catholicism and Judaism parts are the newcomers to this American religion ideal. So in the first half of the 20th century, to be an American was generally to be a white Christian. This is a new move towards greater pluralism and inclusiveness that in the immediate post-war era, we see Jews and Catholics entering that mainstream American religious landscape. And many of us who work on American history or American religion are familiar with the 1955 classic by Will Herberg, Protestant Catholic Jew. That was the title of his book about American religion. And in some ways, it was an amazing PR effort that just in the title alone, he was declaring, this is what an American is now, to be a member of one of these three. There was always something confusing about this, because in what sense was anyone implying that Jews were one third of America? That certainly wasn't true numerically, but it was true that in the post-World War II years, Jews kind of arrive on the American scene in a way they hadn't before. The idea of them being fully American is kind of blossoming in these years in a way that it hadn't in, you know, especially the 20s and 30s and before, when there was more this sense of let's keep America American, meaning let's keep out these immigrants, in particular Catholics and Jews. Sorry, what was the other part of that question? So about the popularity of religion at this mm-hmm. time, some of it does come from just the fact that we're entering a new chapter of American religious history with the rise of the Judeo-Christian tradition. Other scholars and historians have explained this era, but it factors into post-war stories insofar as the popularity of this idea of Judeo-Christianity, the idea that the religious heritage of this country is one that Christians and Jews share, which had not been the case before, but now Americans seem sort of committed to as a way to differentiate themselves from their Cold War enemies and from their enemies during World War II. It becomes part of what it means to be a patriotic American. And that is something that we don't see in other countries in the post-World War II years. I think this was really underlined for me when I was teaching at the University of Toronto for just a couple of years, even in Canada, probably the country we assume is most like the US. I really noticed in talking to people about Jews and Jewish history and getting to know the Jewish community there somewhat, that Jews had not had that same moment of arriving in Canadian culture in quite the same way in the late 40s and 50s.
Very interesting. Thank you for telling us about that. I want to ask a bit more about kind of what sorts of Judaism are being portrayed in this moment, especially if we think of kind of really mass audience types of publications. You talk about Life magazine, Time magazine. What does Judaism look like through these lenses? And to what extent does it change over the course of the 50s?
Thanks for that question, because one of the articles I spend time on is a 1950 article on Judaism in Life magazine. And for this issue, it's a cover story that is about Judaism. And the editors invite a Reform rabbi from Rochester, Rabbi Philip Bernstein, to write an article about Judaism. So it's done through the eyes of a Reform Jew. We don't get a lot of the particularities about Judaism, not much of what would have been Orthodox practice comes through. And interestingly, especially for a magazine like Life, which is so known for its photos, there are no photos of actual Jews in this multi-page article. Instead, they're illustrations. So that sort of caught my attention, not willingness to go there in terms of portraying actual Jews in the article, or to have a very a portrayal of Judaism that would have been very different from Christianity. Instead, it seems like Bernstein is writing with the idea of Judeo-Christianity in mind, with trying to find some parallels between Judaism and Christianity. Whereas just 5 years later, when Judaism does another special issue on Judaism, this time as part of a year when they're looking at world religions, they, in the correspondence between publisher Henry Luce and his editors, Luce expresses his feelings that he'd like to have a more interesting and what he calls colorful portrayal of Jews. And he makes explicit that for him, this will mean looking at Orthodox Jews and looking at Israeli Jews. And they end up featuring an Orthodox family from Scranton, Pennsylvania. And as I found when I researched this, they were specifically looking to combat some stereotypical ideas about Jews. So they were looking for a family that dated back, that had more of a that had at least three generations of a family that had been in the U.S. So instead of this idea that they're all newcomers and immigrants, they wanted a family that had been here for a while. And they were also wanting a family that was not in any of the stereotypical Jewish occupations at the time that meant, that included finance. And hopefully the idea too was to have a family that wasn't in New York. So when they found this Orthodox family that was outside of New York, and that was actually a farming family, this, you know, very much fit with what Luce wanted to portray. And in this article, they did include lots of photos, photos of the family from Scranton, Pennsylvania, but also photos of very religious and Hasidic Jews from both the U.S. and Israel engaged in really particular Jewish activities. So we see the mother and the daughter of the Scranton family washing and separating their dishes into milk and meat sections of their kitchen. And we see one of the young children in the family learning how to put on his tefillin, which the English word for that is phylacteries, but Jews usually know it as tefillin, learning how to put on these black leather straps on his arm and his head. And this is something that would have looked very foreign to non-Jews, and in fact was not something that many non-Orthodox Jews did themselves. What was interesting about this 1955 special issue in Life is that it evoked such a mix of reactions. As I tell in post-war stories, I do think that many modern Orthodox Jews who saw the special issue we're happy about it. We're pleased that it seemed to be a really positive portrayal of their way of life. The family that they chose was middle class, if not upper middle class, and in many ways looked like a typical American family that was committed to its distinctive religious practice. But Reform Jews and Reform rabbis were upset by it. There was, in the letters they wrote to Life and to Life's editors, it's clear that they felt something resembling embarrassment, shame, I think even anger at the magazine for going out of its way to highlight such a different or exotic Jewish family. So it's a reminder, you know, of how much American Jews were not of one mind in the 50s, of course, as they're not today. And also of the power of this popular culture portrayal. That's part of the reason I focused on these kinds of sources, is that Jews themselves realized that these depictions of them were going out into the world in a way that, say, the Yiddish press was not. I think when scholars are looking at the Yiddish press, we're usually looking at sources that we assume are mostly being read by other Jews. And when Jews are looking at these popular culture publications, they sort of show some of this double consciousness of how am I feeling and responding to this depiction, and then how am I thinking that the majority non-Jews who look at this will respond and think about me. So it was, it was interesting to see that divide, and the degree to which this popular culture was able to affirm some Jews' identity and to kind of disrupt other Jews' identity. For the Reform Jews, it felt like their response was, again, as I mentioned before, a kind of embarrassment about having what almost felt like sort of dirty laundry being aired. This sense of like, I didn't need or I didn't want for all these non-Jews to have this kind of picture of us out there, or to think that this is what represents us. So anyway.
No, that's really interesting. And in fact, I'd love to ask you a bit more about kind of how people reacted to this. You talk in the book about there's book clubs, there's letters to the editor, there's all sorts of things going on, especially around these kind of Introduction to Judaism type texts. Could you tell us more about sort of these reactions and receptions to this?
Yeah, I thought that the responses were part of what showed how much cultural work these articles and books were performing. So both with the anti-Semitism novels, I found a lot of letters to the authors from Jews and non-Jews. Again, as I mentioned, because some of the authors were non-Jewish, or the readers thought they were non-Jewish, like Gentleman's Agreement and Joe Sinclair, and that's because of their names, readers assumed they were not Jewish or wondered if they were, and they often asked in their letters, are you Jewish? There was a feeling of gratitude that maybe we're living in a time when non-Jews also feel it's their duty to fight the scourge of anti-Semitism. And so in a way, these writers were helping to create that reality of a post-war America where anti-Semitism had become un-American, and readers were then responding to that by writing into the authors they believed were Gentile and just expressing their appreciation that this is the changed reality, because most of them realized, I couldn't imagine this being the case in 1920s or 1930s America. But by the mid to late 40s, the culture had shifted enough where that now seemed possible. So there was that kind of response of readers being appreciative. There was also the minority of readers who disagreed, or certainly wrote into the authors with their own anti-Semitic views, or those seem to be more along the lines of this is very un-Christian or un-American, or, you know, they wanted to share the anti-Semitic feeling sentiment that they had, but that was definitely the minority. And with the introduction to Judaism literature, the letters from readers to either the authors or the editors and publishers were mostly appreciative, and they came from both Jews and non-Jews, who again were expressing this sense of a changed America, that we're now at a time when life is writing positively about Jews and Judaism. In the book, I reflect on one of the previous times that a Henry Luce publication had really focused on Jews and Judaism, and that was in an article in Fortune magazine from the 30s. And it was just such a much more bleak view of Jews and Judaism, a lot more stereotypical images and a portrayal of Jews as alien and other in American society. So that sort of underlined this sense that there had been a dramatic change in the status of Jews and Judaism in the post-war years. And what I'm explaining that in relation to this popular culture in post-war stories is that this literature was what I call engine and mirror to that change. It's always difficult for scholars to claim that a popular culture causes some change. And certainly I don't think that these books caused change on their own. But as I reflect on in post-war stories, many of us have had experiences like this with novels or movies, that when we read or see something in popular culture, we're kind of interacting with it in conversation with other experiences. And so I mentioned in the introduction about how in my own childhood, the Cosby Show was that kind of popular culture for me. It sort of taught me how to think about Blacks, even though I was growing up in a place, which was the suburbs of Boston, where actually I didn't interact with with Blacks very often at all. And it was really the popular culture that gave me my understanding of them and what I might think or feel or how I might interact with them. For many Americans too, they were not interacting with Jews in the mid-century if they lived in certain parts of the US. So some of these popular books or film or articles in a magazine like Life was kind of their first window into Judaism and Jewish culture,
which has such an impact. So thank you very much for telling us about that aspect of it. Speaking as on this idea kind of change, I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit about kind of almost a compare and contrast, kind of where are we at in 1950 and where are we at in 1960? How is especially the introduction to Judaism, texts and information changing throughout this decade?
Yeah. So in the 50s, I think we do see a good amount of change. As we know, the post-World War II years are years when anti-Semitism is declining, but it's still much worse in the mid to late 40s than it is by the late 50s. But we still have to remind ourselves that even in the late 50s, there were quotas in most Ivy League schools. And it was completely common that country clubs in the US excluded Jews, that it was difficult for Jews to get houses in certain fashionable neighborhoods or to be accepted to certain graduate programs. I've spoken to so many Jews who grew up in the 50s and even early 60s who just had this taken for granted feeling about anti-Semitism. They just knew that certain things were either off limits or very unlikely. And it was so accepted as part of the air you breathe that it wasn't as if Jews were going around expressing moral outrage about this anti-Semitism, which I just want to point out is yet another reason why some of the anti-Semitism novelists did focus on non-Jews, is because then they could portray moral outrage as a believable reaction. It would not have been believable that an adult Jew in the 40s was always shocked and indignant about, every experience of anti-Semitism he encountered. But it's not so unusual that a non-Jew who's just had his eyes open to this fact is going around expressing that kind of sort of righteous indignation feeling. And I think these novelists wanted to kind of remind, re-educate Americans that actually that is the right kind of response we Americans should be having to it, even if the fact is that unfortunately Jews have come to learn to accept this as part of their lives. So back to your question about differences from the kind of 40s to the 60s, by the 60s, I mean, the anti-Semitism is really declining, and it's become much more common that this idea that a good American should be someone without prejudice. I mean, by the early 60s, we've also had our first Catholic president, and, you know, to be thought of or to be called a prejudiced person by someone else, you know, is kind of like today how we say nobody wants to be called racist. What that means is that, of course, behind closed doors, a lot of this anti-Semitism is still going on, but that shift in publicly stated ideals is important. What you're willing or able to say out loud, I think, matters too. And so you know, politicians cannot voice that kind of racism or anti-Semitism or anti-Catholic sentiment. It's not as okay by the early to mid 60s as it had been in, say, the early 40s. Another change I want to highlight is also the evolution of the introduction to Judaism genre. In the book, I talk about how I think of two categories of these books. One is a how-to kind of model, where these were really primers, the books explaining how to be a Jew, you know, which holidays you're going to observe, what ritual is involved. And then the other category I described as a why-to category. And these Introduction to Judaism books are more trying to answer the question of why be a Jew? And some of these authors are starting from the perspective that we live in a time when a Jew doesn't really have to be Jewish if he doesn't want to. And one of the famous versions of this introduction, this kind of introduction to Judaism, was Arthur Cohen's 1959 article in Harper's Magazine called "Why I Choose to Be a Jew." And it almost reminds me of, you know, the growing popularity of memoir in recent decades, because these why-to versions of Introduction to Judaism, which we still see today, really use the author's autobiography, and they often include a section where the author was not very Jewish or was pretty secular, or was maybe, as was the case with Arthur Cohen, even considering conversion to Christianity, and explains why instead they chose to immerse themselves in Judaism or learn more about it. And the Arthur Cohen example I found very compelling because he resembled, I feel, Jews more of the late 20th century and early 21st century in terms of the options he had available to him. He grew up in a pretty wealthy family. He was educated at University of Chicago when he had this kind of crisis of faith. And as he tells in the Harper's article, his parents rushed him to their local rabbi, who was Milton Steinberg of Park Avenue Synagogue. And that relationship ended up being very important to Arthur Cohen, who found his way back to Judaism and became a very important figure in American Jewish thought. So the evolution of Intro to Judaism from how to why to, I think, is also about the growing popularity of bringing your personal story into these explanations of religion.
Really interesting to think about all of that, really just in one decade. So thank you for taking us through it. Is there anything further you'd like to say about kind of the point you made earlier on, like, it in some ways kind of moved anti-Semitism behind closed doors, but that's not nothing? Is there anything further you'd like to say about kind of the extent to which this culture is changing attitudes towards Jews and Judaism?
Yeah, another thanks for allowing me to spend a little more time on that. I guess one of the shifts I'm charting in post-war stories is this move from thinking about Jewishness as tragedy or illness or disability. And as I explained early in the book, I see a lot of that discourse about Jews from both Jewish writers and non-Jews, where they're describing Jewishness as a handicap, you know, sometimes almost literally, that this is a disability you sort of have to learn to resign yourself to. Or sometimes the question is how do we deal with this tragedy of having been born Jewish? Writers mean different things when they're talking about that, but they're all acknowledging that, you know, in the 20s and 30s and early 40s, when I see a lot of this Jewishness as illness discourse, it's a time when being Jewish presents a hardship to Jews. As we discussed before, it means all sorts of exclusions, all sorts of glass ceilings. It makes it hard for young people to pursue all sorts of dreams in terms of education and profession, sometimes even sort of their social lives and who they might want to date or, you know, just be around, be exposed to. So there's that kind of discourse that can, especially when we look at it today, is kind of depressing, to a move towards seeing Jewishness as a proud identity, which is not to say that there were no Jews who felt pride in their Jewishness in the 20s and 30s. But I do think that there is a shift going on in that pre-war to post-war era where it starts to seem more likely or understandable in the post-World War II years, especially by the late 50s and 60s, that a Jew would have a lot to feel pride in and feel that they were sort of lucky to be born into this heritage. You know, the fact that even rabbis, the people who we might think are some of the most committed to their Judaism, even they in the 20s and 30s, for those who write about the psyche of American Jews, they seem very aware that this is how a lot of the Jews in their pews are feeling, that, gosh, it's hard to be born a Jew in 1920s or 1930s America, and many of them have compassion for that. And that seems to be less the case, much less the case by the late 50s and early 60s. And, you know, I felt like that was an important change to think about, because we've, in our own time, have seen many other shifts like that. I mean, in my adulthood, how LGBTQ people might think about their identity, there's been a similar shift in a similarly very short time. So I, you know, as for other groups, it's helpful to think about what kind of role popular culture could play in that change.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So thank you for having kind of investigated, written the book, allowed us to all read it and come to talk to us about it. I do just have one final question. Now that the book is obviously done, what are you working on now?
At the moment, I am working on a biography of Laura Z. Hobson, the author of Gentleman's Agreement, because she was such a fascinating person. She was born in 1900 to Russian Jewish immigrants. Her father helped found the Jewish Daily Forward, and a Yiddish newspaper that is still around today. And her mother was a writer for another Yiddish newspaper. And so she has these real Yiddishist roots. And then she was a real assimilationist success story, to the point, as I mentioned, that when she was in 40s and Gentleman's Agreement, her second novel, came out, readers and viewers of the film did not realize she was Jewish. And she also had a long writing career after that into her 80s. And some of her shifts in how she writes about Jews and Jewish identity, I think, are reflective of changes in how American Jews in general were thinking about Jewishness. So by the 70s, we see much more pride in Jewishness when she's writing about Jews. Also important to point out, she wrote a novel, Consenting Adult, which is a landmark in gay literature that is kind of on the gentleman's agreement model. What I mean by that is just as she chose non-Jewish main characters for Gentleman's Agreement. In Consenting Adult, the main character is the straight Jewish mother who is kind of learning to come to terms with having a gay son. And her son, who was not, or I should say her, she wrote this novel loosely based on her own son, and her son was not initially delighted by that, which is understandable, but he came to understand it later. And eventually, you know, he heard from other gay men that they had kind of used this novel sort of as a tool. They had given it to their parents, since it kind of provides a nice model of how educated middle-class Americans might become sort of allies and might, you know, come to accept having gay children. So that's just one of her other important novels. But she's just kind of a remarkable story. I mean, even she's married to this non-Jewish publisher, Thayer Hobson, in the 30s for 5 years. When they divorce, when she's 35, this is before she's published any novels, they had not been successful in having children, which is something that she wanted. So she adopts on her own from an agency that's still, I think, around in Evanston, Illinois, that sort of catered to wealthy and celebrity parents, which by this point, she kind of almost was. She was sort of a high earning writer. And then she gets pregnant in her early 40s, you know, when she's dating and is a single woman, and decides to have that child on her own because she wants that experience too. So she is a single mother throughout her life. And just a very impressive, interesting woman who crossed paths with many other famous women and men, and who seemed often ahead of her time. So it's been fun working on her.
Well, that sounds like a fascinating project. Best of luck.
Thank you.
And while you are investigating her further, of course, listeners can read a bit about her and about loads of other things in the book that we've been discussing, titled Postwar Stories, How Books Made Judaism American, published by Oxford University Press. Rachel, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Thanks so very much, Miranda. This was a lot of fun.